Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. If you've been conserving energy and cut your energy use to the lowest billing tier, you may be in for a shock. SDG&E wants to jack up rates 24% on those who are using the least power, while actually reducing rates on the largest energy users. The utility justifies this seeming paradox by stating that it costs more to provide power to low-use customers than what SDG&E is receiving from these energy-conscious consumers in rate payments. If fees are not raised on low-use customers, the utility claims it will have to triple its current base rate to its high-energy-use customers. The California Public Utilities Commission would have to approve this plan following public comments. Now, state law currently sharply restricts rate hikes on low-energy-use consumers, which protects people such as seniors on fixed incomes, and it also encourages conservation. SDG&E spokeswoman Stephanie Donovan said, "It's going to feel perhaps uncomfortable for customers in the lower tiers initially." Donovan told the UT that rate hikes would be phased in on what she called a gentle glide path. SDG&E hasn't suffered any losses despite lack of profitability from those who conserve the most and use the least power. In fact, the company's revenues are outpacing inflation, and a four-year rate hike was already recently approved by state regulators to kick in by summer. New laws are encouraging rooftop solar and a shift to renewable power, but utilities have fought to maintain or increase their profits while opposing making solar power more affordable for consumers. The current billing system has let customers who generate power on their roofs avoid certain costs, but utilities want to reduce those incentives for solar and other energy efficiency upgrades. Assembly Bill 325, which takes effect early next year, allows the CPUC to raise fixed fees up to $120 a year and revise the tiered rate structure, which right now is based on how much electricity people actually use. There's also a 2017 deadline for the CPUC to revise net metering provisions that give property owners credits on utility bills for power that they produce with solar. Now, utilities' proposals to fatten up their own corporate coffers and boost shareholder profits with policies that would discourage conservation and reward energy hogs are likely to face stiff opposition from the green energy industry, as well as consumers and consumer watchdog groups. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
A battle is brewing in Congress over unemployment benefits for veterans. Long-term unemployment for 21,000 veterans and many other Americans expired on December, and Congress failed to extend these benefits. Each month, another 3,000 veterans who served our country join the ranks of the unemployed. Many of those are right here in San Diego County. A recent effort by the Senate to extend unemployment benefits for America's veterans was killed by a Tea Party-led filibuster in the Senate that blocked the measure from coming up for a vote. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has committed to keep bringing this issue to a vote until it passes. But to do so, he'll need a few more votes to overcome future filibusters. Next time it happens, we're going to be there with hundreds of personal stories from veterans who lost their benefits and 30,000 supporters who stand ready to take action on their behalf, says John Stoltz, an Iraq War veteran and chairman of VoteVets.org. VoteVets has launched a petition calling on Congress to extend unemployment benefits. So far, over 25,000 veterans, military family members, and supporters have signed it. You can find the petition at their website at www.votevets.org or at our site, www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with today's Green Scene Report. Or perhaps we should call this one the Not-So-Green Report. East County Magazine has conducted a special joint investigation along with the ECO report into water use claims made by Soitec for its four massive solar projects proposed in Boulevard. We found that water experts, including a hydrology professor at San Diego State University, believe these projects would pump out more groundwater than can be replaced by rainwater. The SDSU expert went so far as to conclude that this could destroy the entire ecosystem in this backcountry region. Boulevard was once a quiet rural neighborhood. People moved there to enjoy the open spaces, shady groves of trees, and overall appealing rural community character. The community plan was approved by San Diego's supervisors in 2011, and it prohibited industrial development. But all that changed as supervisors revised Boulevard's community plan over the objections of local residents to make way for large energy projects. Now Soitec Solar is on the verge of utilizing almost 1,500 acres of meadows and wetlands formerly zoned agricultural or residential, back when only one house per 80 acres was allowed. They want to build four projects with thousands of solar panels, each panel 50 feet wide by 30 feet tall. Soitec's developments will use an estimated 50 million gallons of groundwater or more, and according to a report commissioned by the community, Boulevard doesn't have that much water. Dr. Victor Ponce, author of the report, has had 40 years' experience in water resources, and he has taught hydrology at San Diego State University since 1980. The area is forced to rely solely on groundwater, which is replenished only from precipitation, Dr. Ponce said of Boulevard. According to Soitec's consultant, Dudek, the area has sufficient water for the four projects, but Dr. Ponce's calculations show otherwise. The project includes four sites, Rugged Solar, Tierra del Sol Solar, LAN West, and LAN East. Ponce calculates that the proposed Rugged Solar installation in a desert wash will result in total water needed that's 145% more than the mean annual recharge, or what rainfall could replenish. That means that eventually streams, marshes, and springs dry up, he said pointedly. As for the Tierra del Sol project, the total construction water demand for it is over 61 acre-feet. Pumping of this amount of groundwater in 1 year represents 221% of the mean annual recharge, a level of pumping that is sure to place at risk existing natural ecosystems, Ponce concluded. LAN East and LAN West Solar have similarly unsustainable water needs. Ponce said, the wisdom of placing a solar energy project directly on top of a meadow or wetland is highly questionable. Troublingly, true demand during construction has not been clearly established, he noted, and the maximum volume that could be pumped from existing wells without encroaching on established rights is a little over 5 acre-feet, yet the total construction water demand is over 33 acre-feet. That's a whopping 175% of the mean annual recharge. Ponce said this level of pumping is, quote, sure to place at risk existing natural ecosystems, unquote. The San Diego State Hydrology Experts report concluded that no development, no matter how lofty its aim, should place at risk existing natural ecosystems. Other considerations notwithstanding, the Boulevard Soitec projects must resort to imported water to satisfy their needs, he urged. Ponce is not the only water expert questioning Soitec's water usage estimates. Here's what Marty Kennel has to say. His company, Well Done Pump Service and Supply in Boulevard, has been selling, installing, and repairing well water pump systems for 25 years across East County, and he says he has proof of water levels dropping up to 60 feet. He's also seen former year-round creeks that are no longer visible above ground. My personal history in water well systems in the eastern areas of San Diego County leaves me with the opinion that the project presented by Soitec Solar will have a detrimental effect on water supply usage and potability, he wrote in a letter to Robert Hinken at the county's Department of Planning and Land Use Services. Kennel, the well expert, attributes the recent drops in well water in part to growing business and industrial activity. That includes casinos, a new border patrol station, a sheriff station, and SDG&E's power link and substations. Trees are already dying from lack of water, as photos very clearly illustrate. Kennel voiced opposition to selling water for more industrial projects that will use millions of gallons of water amid the drought. When trees die from lack of water, that also heightens fire danger. Just 2 years ago, Boulevard suffered a brush fire that burned many homes and killed a local Boulevard resident. Kennel further said of Soitec's credibility, quote, too much of what Soitec alleges will not affect the residents is just the opposite of what I've found to be fact. Local inhabitants are also concerned that Soitec, like SDG&E in its recent Boulevard substation upgrade, could be seriously underestimating the amount of water required for their project. SDG&E ended up using 3 times more water than it estimated for that substation. This is not the only concern expressed by Boulevard residents. Soitec claims its solar panels have been treated to resist glare, but photos taken at a project by Soitec out in the desert at Newberry Springs clearly show glare. Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, says that no other community is facing this level of unwelcome and unjust conversion in our region. She believes the amendments that made these projects possible also violated residents of Boulevard's rights under the California Constitution. The plan amendments were made to benefit commercial interests at the expense of residents. This is biased, unnecessary, and unjustified, Tisdale said. Now, as for Dr. Ponce, he concluded that the planned industrial-scale development of solar energy in Boulevard and surrounding communities is likely to permanently change the essentially rural character of these East County communities. Residents have attached an online petition asking supervisors to save their water supplies, wildlife, and scenic places by voting no on Soitec's projects in Boulevard and instead putting solar in urban environments. You can read or sign their petition on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. A storm over the past week brought some significant rainfall to Northern California, but it's still just a drop in the bucket toward meeting our drought-parched state's water needs. The National Weather Service in Sacramento tweeted a photo to put things in perspective. It showed a 5-gallon bucket, which represents the amount of water needed by the state, with a 10-ounce cup of coffee to represent how much rain has actually fallen. Making matters worse, soils are so dry and hard from lack of rain over many years that some of the recent rainfall has just run off instead of soaking in to replenish groundwater supplies. Still, the rain brings welcome relief to drought-stricken cities and farmers. A state drought monitor report issued late last week indicated that 94% of the state remains in drought condition, with 10% experiencing exceptional drought, the worst category. So consumers are urged to continue conserving water where you can.
This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat report for East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio. If you're a homeowner planning to tint your house to get rid of termites, you'd better beware of a new breed of unwanted pests. Thieves wearing respirators are breaking into homes that are tinted for termites, entering homes filled with toxic chemicals, and making off with homeowners' belongings. This happened about a week ago to a friend of our editor's. Though the latest victim lives in a coastal community, our research reveals that several crimes have been occurring across San Diego County for the past several years, including cases in East County and San Diego. Termite companies may advise homeowners to leave windows open for ventilation. Some fail to warn homeowners about the brazen crimes, but others are warning residents to take precautions. Sheriff's spokesperson Jan Caldwell told us that she had her own house tinted last October. The company told us about this potential issue, she said, adding, "They recommended I remove valuables and important papers. They also suggested I contact the police department for drive-by checks." Our editor's friend, who asked that her name not be stated in this report, said she had planned to hire a private security guard starting on the second day of tinting, since the exterminator advised it would be too toxic for thieves on the first day. But the bad guys took a risk and broke in on the first night, a dangerous but daring ploy. The victim had these tips to offer others planning to tint for termites. "My advice is you take out your firearms, your money, and your jewelry. Hiring a security guard may be costly but worth it to prevent being victimized by these persistent pests. Some homeowners who can't afford that have opted to camp out in front of their tented homes to keep watch. It's also a good idea to ask neighbors to keep an eye on your property during fumigation."
A new sheriff's substation is now open on Campo Road in Rancho San Diego, near the intersection of Highways 54 and 94. The new station will serve the communities of Rancho San Diego, Spring Valley, La Presa, Jamul, Casa de Oro, Mount Helix, and the unincorporated portions of La Mesa and El Cajon. The Lemon Grove station will become a substation, but it will have a smaller staff contracted to serve the city of Lemon Grove, since the new substation will serve communities formerly under the Lemon Grove substation's jurisdiction. The new facility opens with 90 to 100 staff who are moving from the Lemon Grove substation. Sheriff Bill Gore says the department looked at more than 12 sites before choosing this location. It's long overdue, but when we're done here, it's going to be a really, truly state-of-the-art facility, he said during a prior groundbreaking ceremony. Supervisor Diane Jacobs said, to the community, it means faster response times to emergencies. I have to tell you, I'm thrilled. Jacob initiated the board action for the facility, which originally was proposed as a substation, though she quipped, there may be a few criminal wrongdoers that won't be quite so thrilled. The new site has a more convenient and strategic location, according to the sheriff's office. It will include 27,000 square feet for the substation on a 5-acre lot and will include patrol, operations, investigations, office space, and support facilities. The new substation is also green, featuring recycled building materials, natural lighting during the daytime, energy-efficient systems, low-water-use landscaping with drought-tolerant and indigenous plants, as well as bioswales for stormwater management. The total project budget, including land acquisition, planning, design, and construction, is $17.5 million. For East County Magazine, this is Ariel Johansson reporting.
County supervisors have unanimously approved a new law that's designed to help make sure foreign students learning to fly at our county airports are undergoing federal background checks. Federal government has legal authority over aviation in the U.S. and requires anybody who's not a citizen to undergo background checks before they can take flight training. But in 2012, a report issued by the Federal Government Accounting Office stated that there were concerning gaps in that background check system over a decade after the 9/11 attacks. Now, that's of special concern here in San Diego County, which has 14 private flight schools and about 1,200 flight instructors working at county-operated airports. Here in East County, foreign pilot training has increased sharply at Gillespie Field in El Cajon. And at least two of the 9/11 hijackers lived right here in San Diego. Shortly after that report came out, county supervisors directed Public Works on September 11, 2012, the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, to work with local groups and draft an ordinance that would require flight schools and instructors to certify that they were complying with the federal law. The ordinance supervisors approved will require those flight schools that train foreign student pilots at any of the county's airports to sign a form every single year stating that they're complying with the federal background check law. Board Chairwoman Diane Jacobs said of the measure, "We have more reason today than ever before to have this certification in place." The county ordinance has to be approved a second time when the board meets February 26th. The County Department of Public Works officials said they'll begin enforcing this new ordinance when the new fiscal year begins July 1st. In addition to approving the local ordinance, supervisors unanimously agreed to increase efforts to lobby the federal government to fix the gaps in federal law and to increase communications with flight schools and teachers to make sure they're aware of the background check rules. They also want to tell other counties statewide about the new ordinance and bring it back to the board for a review in a year to see how the ordinance is working. The county's new background check law for foreign pilots was opposed by the flight schools, but had strong support from groups representing local residents living near the airports. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The majority of California's fourth graders aren't making the grade when it comes to reading. A new report finds only one in four California fourth graders are reading at grade level. Ted Limpert with Children Now says reading scores are a key predictor of long-term academic and economic success.
We're seeing some of the consequences of that in today's economy. You know, a number of Californians who unfortunately don't have the skills to get some available jobs that are out there, and that trend is only going to continue as jobs require more and more skills.
Governor Jerry Brown's proposed state budget includes the implementation of a new school funding formula, as well as an increase in per pupil spending for K through 12 students. Limpert says California still places well below the national average for education spending. He says the proposed budget also fails to include adequate funding for early education and development programs, which are known to play a critical role in preparing all children for success in school.
So while some very positive things have occurred, we really need to double down, not only ensuring that we do even more in terms of education spending, but really start early.
The 2014 California Children's Report Card, released earlier this month by Children Now, showed only half of the state's 3- and 4-year-olds are enrolled in preschool, with significant disparities by race and income. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
Attention high school seniors. You can receive free cash for attending financial aid workshops. In an effort to increase the number of high school students in the San Diego area who apply for free college financial aid, 13 Cash for College workshops will be held in late January and February. Last year, San Diego area students who participated in these workshops were offered over $3 million in federal and Cal Grant aid. Seniors who attend a workshop and apply for a Cal Grant by March 2nd deadline could qualify for an extra $1,000 in cash for college scholarship offered at each workshop. Workshop information is available at www.calgrants.org/workshops. Local public officials, including Congressman Scott Peters, State Senator Marty Block, and Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, held an event last week to speak out and encourage students to attend these workshops. College financial aid increases opportunities for students to attend a college or university of their choice. The Public Policy Institute of California estimates that the state will need an additional 1 million Californians with 4-year degrees or higher by 2025, because 41% of the state's jobs will require a bachelor's degree or higher. Currently, only 35% of adults will be prepared to meet this demand, so increasing college access and affordability is essential. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Julian Rudfalls.
This is Ed Barreno with KNSJ, the Health Report. Are babies and children at risk of suppressed immune systems from wildfire smoke? A new study at the University of California, Davis suggests this could be the case. The study was conducted by the university and by the California Air Resources Board. It looked at 25 young rhesus monkeys born at the university's Primate Research Center during the summer of 2008, when smoke from over 2,000 fires that burned over 1 million acres drifted into the area. The monkeys born during the wildfires and who were living outdoors were found to have suppressed immune systems. Their blood samples were placed in tissue culture dishes, then exposed to disease pathogens. When compared to 25 other monkeys born a year later, they showed a reduced ability to generate immune responses to diseases. Lisa Miller, professor of veterinary medicine at UC Davis, called the findings surprising and somewhat disturbing. Before, conventional wisdom in medicine had assumed that smoke or other irritants would cause the immune system to ramp up. But instead, this study found just the opposite. Researchers also measured the effects of fine particulate matter lodged deep in the lungs and found very high levels. Wildfire smoke also causes high ozone levels, which is linked to asthma, lower birth weights, and heart problems. Development of children's lungs, which take 18 years to fully mature, is also a key concern. Another study is planned at the University of California, this time on the impacts of wildfire smoke on people living there. The findings are particularly troubling here in wildfire-prone San Diego's East County, which in 2003 and 2007 had the two worst firestorms in California history. With climate change bringing hotter, drier weather, more severe fires are predicted. If smoke from fires can harm the lungs and immune systems of children, that could have implications for CAL FIRE and the Forest Service, which have increased controlled burns as a means of preventing out-of-control wildfires. We don't know yet if that would prevent us from using prescribed fires as a tool, Forest Service ecologist Andrzej Bitnarowicz said, the Sacramento Bee reports. Meanwhile, it's best to err on the side of caution when the next wildfire strikes. Keep children indoors if possible until the smoke clears.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Laurel Corona, award-winning author of three novels, Finding Emily, Penelope's Daughter, and The Four Seasons, a novel of Vivaldi's Venice. My guest has twice won the prestigious Theodore S. Geisel Award at the San Diego Book Awards. She has also worked as an English and Humanities professor and dean here at San Diego State University and at the University of California in San Diego. Welcome, Laurel. It's a pleasure having you on our show.
Thanks for having me, Raina.
Let's start with your novel, Finding Emily, which won the Geisel Award in 2012. Tell us a little bit about this book, what inspired you to write it, and why you believe that it was chosen to be the best book published in San Diego that year.
Well, I'm delighted it was chosen. I'm not sure I really know why. There's an awful lot of good writers in San Diego. The reason that I write historical fiction is that I'm interested in stories of forgotten women. Our history is so lost, and whenever I run into a mention of a woman that I think everybody ought to know about, it's very inspiring to me to go and say, well, what is her story? How could I turn it into a novel? Because it's really a form of combining my love of writing and teaching. So Emily du Châtelet is a wonderful, extremely talented and brilliant physicist and mathematician in pre-revolutionary France, who is a footnote, if at all, in any book, because she was Voltaire's lover. But she's so fabulous in her own right, brilliant and iconoclastic, and she was a cross-dresser, she was a gambler, she was just a wild woman, in addition to being one of the most brilliant physicists of her time. And I thought, why don't we know about her? And I decided to do something about it by writing a novel. That's really always been the reason that I've written my novels, is that I get something in my mind that people really need to know something about women's history. Mm-hmm. And my way of doing that for a larger audience than my own classes is to write.
How do you choose the women? I mean, there must be many forgotten women, as you say.
There are. They choose me. I really have that feeling. It's sometimes I feel that they just sort of jump on me and won't let me go. They say, write about me, write about me. And so they get under your skin. And, uh-huh. and it also has to be a story that's interesting, not just an interesting or an accomplished woman, but she has to have a pretty fabulous story that I think really needs to be told. In my first novel, for example, in The Four Seasons, I wanted to write about this unbelievable institution in Venice that took in female orphans and raised them to be either marriageable or become nuns. And one of the things that they taught them to do to make them marriageable was to play musical instruments and sing. And they discovered that they had a very talented group, that if they really developed this talent, that they could use it financially in this for this institution. So by the time Vivaldi comes on the scene, who's one of the characters in the novel, this institution of female orphan musicians had one of the great orchestras and choirs in Europe.
Wonderful.
And that's not an exaggeration. It really was. And it was only because Vivaldi had these women to compose for. He was not a composer when he first came to the Pietà. He was just a violinist, a violin instructor. And with this group of women, he had the means to become the composer that he was, because anything that he could compose, they could play. And so he wouldn't be Vivaldi without them. And I thought, why do we not know this?
Yes. So it's not that women have recently played a big role in society, it's that they've always been there.
We have always been there. I mean, obviously we've always been half of the population, but honestly, the more I research the women that I think about writing about, the more I think we've just been sold a bill of goods about women's role in history. We've kind of been told that women just darned socks and and minded their husbands and died in childbirth. And beyond right. that, we beyond that, they really weren't doing anything. And when you think about it, that's a really pretty poisonous thing to say to women, because it essentially says you really didn't do much in the past that was worth noticing. And I'm finding that there were always women who were always doing interesting things, always bucking trends, always asking questions. There are so many women that shatter that mold that we really ought to stop telling people that women were sort of these ancillary people in history. I think we've always been central to every important story.
The best kept secret.
We are the best kept secret.
Mm-hmm. So do you do a lot of reading on your own, or is it preparation for teaching humanities that you come upon these women?
It's mostly in connection with humanities in one way or another. I ran across a reference to the female orphan musicians in a humanities book.
Okay.
And I've run across just references to things in general. So I would say most of it's that, but there's just stories that stick with me that mm-hmm. I want to tell. Mm-hmm. The novel that is going to be released in March of 2014, The Mapmaker's Daughter, is about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. And I think that that's important because, you know, if you're raised in the United States, you sort of see Ferdinand and Isabella as these rather dazzling leaders who sponsored Columbus, were so wise to do that. But so the year 1492 was a big year in a number of different ways, including at the beginning of the year, overcoming the last Muslim territory in Spain, the Caliphate of Granada, and ending one of the most dynamic and phenomenal cultures that ever was in the world. And then later that year, they got the brilliant idea that Spain would be better off without its Jews. And so they expelled all the Jews from Spain. So I thought people need to know that.
Yes.
A lot of people don't. And because I'm interested in women, the novel is told from the point of view of women. It's told from the perspective of a very elderly woman who's waiting to be taken out of Spain in 1492. And she is going back through her life. And we're learning about women, and in a multi-generational way, what women's roles were in the Jewish community, what they did, what their customs were, and just how strong they were, and the leadership that they showed, even though men are the ones whose names are mentioned.
Right. I look forward to reading that. That's actually my ancestral history.
Oh, Sephardic Judah, Jewish?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. There isn't that much Sephardic literature.
No.
So that's something that I think is special about it as well.
Yes. Well, that leads me to my next question, which is on your website biography, you say that learning is the second most exciting thing in life and sharing with the others is first. What started that philosophy in your life?
You know, I don't know that it ever started. I just find whenever I learn anything, I'm looking around for somebody I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
I've just always been that way. Anything that I know, I want to share.
Natural teacher.
I think probably. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I was probably born to be a teacher. And then because I love to write, it's this great combination of things. So when I hear an interesting story, the first thing I think is, can I make a novel out of this?
Uh-huh.
Or even just little things. If I read something in the news, I want to go tell somebody about it. So mm-hmm. it just feels as natural as breathing to me to want to share anything that I know.
Well, I know that in the 1990s, you wrote 17 young adult titles.
I was very busy.
Yeah, for Lucent Books. Are those books still available, and do you miss writing for young adults?
They are still available. They were library books. They were contract books that I wrote, so they're mostly on countries, but a few of them are not. So, yes, they're in libraries, but quite frankly, it'd be sort of sad if they're in libraries because they're fairly dated at this point. I know the one I wrote on Afghanistan, I wrote right after 9/11 because I thought it would be interesting to know more about the country of Afghanistan, and so it ends with Hamid Karzai has been elected. We'll see how that works out. So that tells you how you know, you can't really have a book that's current for more than a few years. But
no.
I think I did a good job on the history and other things so that they would still be valuable for that. But I wanted to write for young adults because there's an interesting challenge in it to figure out how to take adult information and not dumb it down, because
no.
one of the things that I loved about Lucent Books was that they did not think that young adults were dumb. They did not think they should be spoken down to at all. So it was like how to present it on their intellectual level
mm-hmm.
In a way that really honored their intelligence mm-hmm. was the challenge in it. But after a while, because they were fairly cookie cutter in terms of their organization, I just wanted to move on and do something that where there would be kind of a new journey for me.
In your opinion, what's the biggest challenge that you have now? How do you navigate the complicated facts and tidbits? And the research part floors me. So you get this history, you haven't lived it. How do you make it real?
It is an additional challenge in historical fiction, certainly. I found, though, that it's not perhaps as central a part of the writing as an outsider might think, because what I've really learned is that every kind of fiction is going to rise and fall on whether there's a dynamite plot and wonderful characters. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be whether it's set in by the water cooler in an office or whether it's set in medieval Europe. You have to have a great story and you have to have great characters. And I find for the historical part of it that I become interested in a real person. And then I try to figure out what kind of story can I weave around them. So I do a lot of research about, I read any biography of any character that's going to be in the book. I read histories. I read things like that. But then I put them away. I don't spend as much time as I think some authors, historical fiction authors do, in advance, because I've really found if you do too much research in advance, it almost gets in the way, because you get so wrapped up, like I would, because I want to teach everybody everything I know, that I would get wrapped up in wanting to share information. And the problem with that is that you're not in the story when you're doing that. The best piece of advice I ever got was from my sister, who doesn't read very much fiction except mine. And when she was reading my first novel, The Four Seasons, and she said, I was so totally in this story, I forgot I was reading a book. Then you started teaching me, and I realized, oh, yes, this is a book. And she said, I don't want to feel like I'm reading a book. And I learned from that no, I have to just shut my mouth. And if I can't figure out a way to work it in the story, it's not in the story, as opposed to jumping out of.
Right.
And I think that it really does help to not have too many things that you just say, oh, I've just got to put this in the book.
Right.
Because then the research starts driving the novel, and the research should be just enriching the novel.
So to go by the character's agenda rather than the author's agenda.
Absolutely. And I've learned that. So my first one, I kind of treated like a doctoral dissertation and went and got piles and piles of books. Now I read just enough to know that I've got, that I can tell this story, that it's a plausible story, mm-hmm. that I know who has to be in it, I know what events mm-hmm. I want to have in it. And then I just let the characters go and just see what happens.
One last question, Laurel. What do you think are the strengths of the San Diego writing community? That's always a favorite topic of all the authors I interview. Do you have any words of inspiration for our listeners? Do you have anything about your work process that you'd like to share? Or how to tap into the writing community, which I understand is quite active and robust.
It is active and robust. And for me, it seems like it's just the right size. If you're mm-hmm. in a large city, it would be harder to get bookstores to have you come and read because there's so many authors. And it seems like it's just the right size community. So I feel like I know a substantial number of the writers in the community. And there's opportunities to get together and things like that. So for me, it's a really wonderful and dynamic writing community that's mm-hmm. really quite supportive. And it's been a real enrichment to my life to be part of it. The one thing that I think is missing is that there isn't a really good mechanism that I'm aware of anywhere whereby writers and readers can actually talk about books. And writers will go to, I know I go to a lot of book clubs. I'm happy to come to book clubs when people read my novels. And so that's very interesting, but it's private. Mm-hmm. And other than that, most of the time what authors are doing is standing there talking to audiences, sometimes of writers and sometimes of readers. But just this interchange, just to be able to talk mm-hmm. over coffee or to talk over dinner or something like that is really not easy to do. Mm-hmm. And so there's a new group that I've been involved in forming called Authors and Readers Roundtable, which is meant to address this by having opportunities for writers and readers, me and a couple of my friends as the writers, to come together in a restaurant with people who just want to talk about books. Mm-hmm. And they want to hear a little bit about us as writers. But the real emphasis is just talking about books. I'm interested, for example, in what makes a person read the second page of a book.
Right.
What makes you put it down? What would make you read another book by the same author?
Right.
And we don't have a real mechanism to ask those kinds uh-huh. of questions. And so I'm hoping that this community, which we just started, which anyone is welcome to be part of who's listening to this, would be a means whereby we could just really have that kind of dynamic conversation. It's called
idea.
Authors and Readers mm-hmm. Roundtable. And I think probably if a person just Googled that and maybe put San Diego on it, that they would be able to find our website.
It's an exciting idea.
Thanks.
So I guess the last thing that I'd like to hear from you is, when do you write? You're a full-time professor. You're involved in community activities. So what is your schedule?
I kind of wrote like a maniac for a few years. I had a number of books that were burning mm-hmm. in me, and I would just get up really early. I had to have a deal with myself that I would not get up before 6, because if I said I could get up before 6, I would be getting up at 4. And so I would have to lay in bed. Even if I thought about the book, I had to lay in bed until 6, and then I could get up. And because I don't teach until the middle of the day, I could actually put in most of a day, or a good 3/4 of a day of work before I went off to teach my classes. So it's a great job. Being a professor, I control my time better than some people do. But honestly, I think, and this is certainly easier for me because I'm not raising children at this point or anything like that, that I really control my own time more than a lot of people do. But honestly, I think if you don't waste time, there's an awful lot of time in the day.
So your inspiration to writers out there listening would be find the time.
Find the time. And if you can't find the time, be realistic about how long it's going to take you to accomplish what you want to accomplish. If you can't find the time because you've got little kids, then say, I bet it's going to take me 5 years to write my novel. And just don't beat yourself up about it.
Okay. Good advice. Laurel, our time is up, but thanks again for joining us. For more information on Laurel Corona and her books, please visit her website at www.laurelcorona.com, and that's L-A-U-R-E-L. So thank you for coming. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week on Destination East County, we're bringing you some fun and delicious Valentine's Day events later on in the segment after our other fun and interesting events happening in East County this week. Detroit Underground will be playing at the Viejas Dreamcatcher Showroom on both Friday, February 14th at 9 p.m. and Saturday, February 15th at 9 p.m. Detroit Underground is a 9-piece band that plays blues and soul, covers, standards, and funk. An antique and collectible show will be held on Wednesday, February 12th at the Ronald Reagan Community Center on Douglas Avenue in El Cajon, from 12 to 4 p.m. Visitors can see great collectibles at the event, from artwork to jewelry. There is free parking and free admission. The play Annie goes on stage during the weekend of Friday, February 14th, and for the following 2 weekends, performed by the Christian Youth Theater with such songs as Tomorrow and It's a Hard Knock Life. This production of Annie is appropriate for the whole family. The cast and crew of this musical features students from across San Diego County, ages 8 to 18 years. The performances will be held at the Greenfield Middle School on Greenfield Drive in El Cajon. Visitors to Mission Trails Regional Park can take a hike to Bird Oak Grove on Saturday, February 15th from 8 to 10 a.m., where winter birding is at its best. With MTRP birding guide Gene Ramon for Avian Adventure, on Oak Grove Loop Trail, San Diego's mild climate hosts both migratory and local birds. Binoculars and bird book are recommended. Participants are asked to meet in front of the visitor center. Then on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, February 17th, 18th, and 19th, at Mission Trails Regional Park, families can look forward to a presentation for those 3 years old and up called Bothersome But Beneficial, Backyard Bandits. With puppets, pelts, songs, specimens, scat, tracks, and a craft and nature walk, kids can learn about nature's nocturnal nuisances, raccoons, skunks, and opossums. The Canyoneers from San Diego Natural History Museum will be leading a nature walk and hike in the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, also on Saturday, February 15th, starting at 9 a.m. to the Indian Hill area in the park. This walk hike is rated moderate, with a boulder scramble 6 miles up to a 1,000-foot elevation change. Participants can hike through hillsides of teddy bear cholla and barrel cactus to visit the remains of a primitive 1912 railroad camp. Please check the San Diego Natural History Museum website at www.sdnhm.org/calendar for info, directions, and applicable parking fees. Allow about 2 hours driving time from San Diego. Canyoneers are San Diego Natural History Museum volunteers trained to teach appreciation of plants and animals in Southern California. Walks are open to the public and no reservations are required. Now for some Valentine's Day fun in East County. If your Valentine likes the band Lone Star, they will be performing on Valentine's Day, Friday, February 14th at 8 p.m. at Saquon in El Cajon. Lone Star has reunited with their original lead singer, Richie McDonald, who also plays piano. And this multi-platinum country music quartet also includes Michael Britt on lead guitar and backing vocals, Keach Rainwater on drums, and Dean Sams on keyboards, acoustic guitar, and backing vocals. Lone Star is known for merging their country roots with strong melodies and rich vocals. 2 days later, on Sunday, on February 16th at 8 p.m., Clint Black will be performing at Saquon. Sweethearts can also head up to Ramona's Wine Country for a special Valentine's Day weekend, Friday through Sunday from 12 to 5 p.m. each day, and enjoy Ramona's East End Winery Loop, a scenic drive connecting three local wineries, Ramona Ranch, Vineyard Grant James, and Turtle Rock Ridge. Each winery will be providing a special pairing in honor of Valentine's Day during the weekend. Guests are invited to meet the winemakers, bring a picnic lunch, and a well-mannered dog if you want to, and enjoy handcrafted local wine and spectacular views at these three wineries located just minutes from each other. Visit the website www.RamonaValleyWineRegion.com to find out more about this newest grape-growing and winemaking region with more than 50 vineyards right here in East County. Now for some delicious Valentine's Day gustatory treats. All of our featured restaurants offering a Valentine's Day special menu are award-winning restaurants right here in East County. Hacienda Casablanca on North Johnson in El Cajon has a special menu created by Chef Esteban that will be available as well as their regular menu. The Valentine's menu includes a choice between lobster Puerto Nuevo, garlic cilantro mahi, and New York steak. Dinner is served from 5 to 10 p.m. on Friday, February 14th. Also, every Tuesday at Hacienda Casablanca, guests can enjoy the music of guitarist Mike Dwyer from 7 to 10 p.m. for Taco Tuesdays. And on Wednesday nights, the Mambo Trombo Trio plays with Dave Scott on trombone and vocals, Irving Flores on piano, and Tommy Aros on congas. The music is live from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Bistro 60 in San Diego Desserts is offering a special Valentine's Day menu for Friday, February 14th, and Saturday, February 15th. Their full dinner menu will also be available, which now includes a Brussels sprout salad with red onion, sunflower seeds, blue cheese, Parmesan, and balsamic. For the Valentine's Day and day after menu, diners can choose between the following appetizers: fennel and arugula salad with chèvre, honey vinaigrette and spice almonds, or leche de tigre with lemon, coconut milk, chill, and shrimp skewer, or cream asparagus soup with roasted asparagus, goat cheese, crostini, and chili oil. For the main course, the three choices are the following: baked lamb shanks with purple cauliflower puree and roasted fingerling potatoes, pan-seared duck breasts with blueberry port reduction, apricot tea risotto, and asparagus. And lastly, diver scallops with roasted corn and avocado salad and quinoa. Terra American Bistro on El Cajon Boulevard in La Mesa is offering a special Valentine's Day dinner with seating beginning at 4:30 p.m. All of the main dishes have suggested wine pairings. To begin, appetizer choices are saucy oyster shooters, lobster bisque, and beets and greens with goat cheese. The first main entree choice is filet mignon with a porcini red sauce, lobster fennel couscous, and market vegetables. The next choice is Duca crusted sea bass with a caramelized onion thyme cream, sweet potato gnocchi, and market vegetables with truffle oil. The last choice is grilled vegetable Napoleon with caramelized onion and roasted butternut squash risotto. To finish off the meal, diners can expect a dessert sampler to share of Sunset Kiss containing white chocolate, a Ganduja Crunch Pyramid with a hazelnut milk chocolate base, and a hibiscus blood orange tart with hibiscus-infused lemon curd. Jeremy's on the Hill in the Wainola area of Julian is offering a Valentine's Day aphrodisiac tasting menu. Jeremy's recently appeared in the San Diegan magazine. Early reservations are a must for this special dinner, starting with watermelon and asparagus tip salad on organic greens with champagne strawberry vinaigrette, chevret goat cheese, pomegranate jewels, and balsamic reduction. Then for the main course, there are pan-roasted diver scallops wrapped in cooked pig's ranch prosciutto on a bed of saffron risotto. Asparagus puree and rose petal sea salt is included. Then finish with the dessert of chocolate lava cake with vanilla bean cream anglaise and brandy cherry compote. There will be a dessert and wine pairing at the San Pasquale Winery Tasting Room and Gallery on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa on three separate nights, including Valentine's Day. Those dates are Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, February 12th through 14th, from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. The desserts are hand-selected and paired with several wines. There will be Grand Marnier mousse, white chocolate raspberry cake, chocolate-covered bacon, and a mocha-filled chocolate cup. It's military appreciation for spouses during Valentine's Week from Bellis Academy, where military spouses can come in for free services, including makeup application, shampoo and conditioning treatments, manicures and pedicures, and waxing services, all gratis for military spouses. This year, the National City and El Cajon locations are participating with Bellis Academy on Poway Road in Poway. Military spouses must be 18 and older. Available hours for appointments are Tuesday, February 11th, Wednesday, February 12th, and Thursday, February 13th. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found in our calendar and in our festivals and events section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Our Destination East County segment on the East County Magazine radio show is supported by our listeners and by a community enhancement grant from the County of San Diego.
See you around, East County.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. It's time to start planting for this fall, and that means you need your tools to be in good shape. So how exactly do we keep our tools in good shape? Well, for one thing, we don't leave them laying out in the rain, if it ever rains again. And we don't want to put them away dirty with mud on them and dirt on them. We want everything to be cleaned up and put in a proper place inside the garage, the basement, or a tool shed of some sort. One of the cute ideas that some of my students like is buying an old used mailbox at a garage sale and posting that someplace in their garden so they can have a second set of tools or even a third one out there to grab when they see something they need to do, and that way they don't have to go all the way back to the house to get the right tool, and it is out of the way. Now, how do we clean these tools when we're through with them? Well, obviously, you can hose off your shovels, rakes, hose, things like that. I have a trick that I learned years ago that I really enjoy, and I think it's wonderful. And even my husband, who's not quite as hyper attuned to cleaning tools as I am, likes this one. We take an old cat litter box, and we fill it with sand, and pour a quart of motor oil into it, stir it up real well. And we can slide the shovels, the rakes, and everything into that box and get a light coating of oil on the tools before we hang them up. This also has the benefit of taking the small nicks and scrapes off the edges of the tools before you put it away. Sometimes we have wooden handle tools. I love wooden handle tools. They're much better than fiberglass as far as I'm concerned. How do you keep those wooden handles nice? That's the job for a little bit of sandpaper sometimes, and then coat them about once a year with boiled linseed oil. You can also use mineral oil. You can also use expensive olive oil. The point is, you're using an oil on these wooden handles at least once a year to keep them smooth and working well.
When you are using your tools for pruning outside, your loppers, your hand pruners and everything, they have a tendency to get gummy. They get all sorts of sap on them. There's an expensive product out there that you can buy that'll remove that, but you can also remove it, the sap and the gumminess on the blades of your tools with alcohol, just plain rubbing alcohol on a rag. Rub it onto the gicky stuff on the edge of the tools, and then leave it for 3 or 4 minutes. And then when you come back, you can use that same rag and just wipe them off totally clean. There is also a tiny tool out there. It costs about $10 or $12. Look for it, and you will find it. It is a gardening tool sharpener, which you run over the blades of your loppers and your hand pruners, your bypass tools, and it will clean them, and it will sharpen them again instantly. 3 passes, and you're good. It is not the same as a knife sharpener, so don't buy a knife sharpener and think that's going to work. What other tools do we need to take care of? Well, you need to take care of your hands. So for that, I recommend you get some really good gloves. Gloves that are fabric that have a vinyl-dipped fingers and hands and palms are absolutely great. They last longer than you think they will. Sometimes at one of the big box stores, you can buy a package of 6 or 8 pairs of these for about $1 a pair. They're worth their weight in gold. They'll keep your hands from feeling like, as my husband once said to me, holding hands with you is like holding hands with a pineapple. You can avoid that by wearing gloves when you do your gardening. And then I want to say a kind and loving word towards your favorite item that you need here where we water every week, and that is your garden hoses. Garden hoses should never be stowed with kinks in them. That destroys the hose in record time. Also, when the hoses are stretched out and you're using them, don't step on them. You may think that it's not going to do any harm, but it will, because small rocks can poke a hole in the side of your expensive garden hose, faster even in your cheaper garden hoses. So don't do that. Be kind to your garden hoses. Coil them up nicely with no kinks and put them away after each use.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.